Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Cathode Ray Mission. I'm your host, Adam Ferens, and tonight the topic is Bride's Head Revisited, the landmark 1981 adaptation by Granada Television of Evelyn Waugh's classic novel. Joining me tonight as my guests are Howard Kastner. Say hello.
Hello.
And Aaron White. Say hey.
Hey.
So, you know, this wasn't in the questions that I had posed to you guys before this, but I'm going to jump back a little bit from that. I'll let you start it. So, Howard, would you like to give a brief synopsis for the listeners out there who maybe don't know what Bride's Head is about? Would you like to tell them a little bit about what it's about before we jump into the discussion?
Okay. Well, it starts in the early parts of World War II and revolves around Charles Ryder. And it's his flashback to when he met Sebastian Flight in the 1920s and the Flight family, who are longstanding Catholics and are wealthy landed gentry. He falls in love with Sebastian. They meet at Oxford, and they have a passionate affair. But Sebastian is an alcoholic and eventually disappears in Africa. He goes on his way as a painter, marries, discovers his wife is cheating on him, meets up with Sebastian's sister, Julia, falls in love with her, wants to marry her, but she's married to, but she's already married to a converted Catholic, and so they have to figure out how to do this, how do they divorce everybody. The problem is the Catholicism, you know, having to divorce and not being able to divorce, what to do about that. As the war approaches, the head of the family, Lord Marchmain, comes home to Bride's Head, which is where the head of the family, the Bride's Head Castle, which is where the main estate is of the Marchmain family. He converted to Catholicism to marry Sebastian's mother, but has become lapsed in Italy with mystics, but he's died. And though Charles is an atheist or an agnostic, as he says, they are trying at the last moment to give, how much detail? Do you want me to give away the ending and everything?
No, I think that's sufficient.
Okay.
So, you know, I want to ask, that's good. Thank you. So I'm going to go with you for the first part of the question, Aaron. So you just recently came to this show, yeah?
I just watched it for the first time, like, this month. I knew of the book. It's on a lot of those influential novels lists. I have an English degree, I was familiar with the book's title, and I was familiar with the miniseries because you and I talk about TV a lot.
Yeah.
But I'd never actually seen it until last month. When you pitched the show to me, and I was like, I'll try to get it in. So, yes, very recent to the series.
And Howard, you?
Well, I saw it when it first appeared on television. I think I may have seen it twice this time, so this is my third time. I've actually read the book twice, and I've read a number of other. The majority, probably, of Evelyn Waugh's fictional books of fiction.
Yeah, I first came to this. I was aware of it. I think I'd seen bits of it years ago when it had been repeated on television. But as with a lot of other shows that we've been covering on this program, I came to it in the last 6 or 7 years as part of my large ongoing television project. And, you know, it stuck with me. Now, it started off when I initially ranked it. I had it up like around 11 all-time programs, 10, 11. It's now fallen to 16, but I don't want people to really think it's a fall as much as it is that I've watched other shows that I prefer a little more, because this is, for me, absolutely one of the great achievements in television. So, you know, and that is something that I did want to ask. For you, Aaron, where do you rank this among miniseries?
I have it in my top 10 miniseries. I think that you may like it slightly more than I do, but I really appreciate it. I really thought it was a wonderful piece of work. Slight miniseries, I have it at number 9. And then if you include TV movies, it's number 10. So... Not bad. By any
no, stretch. No, not bad. I mean, you know, for me, just among miniseries, it goes Fanny Alexander, Haymont, Decalogue, Berlin Alexander Platts, Singing Detective, and then this. So, you know, it's definitely top 10 for me. What about you, Howard?
Well, whenever anybody asks me, I always have a knee-jerk reaction and say it's my favorite. And then I have to stop and think about it and say, no, it's not my favorite. I can't really say that it's better than Fanny and Alexander or Scenes from a Marriage or Berlin Alexander Platz and things like that. It's just that I have an incredible affection for it, and it meant a lot to me when I saw it. So I tend to be more excited about it. Whenever I talk about it. But it's only in the top 10, around 5, 6, 7, something like that. At the same time, it's obvious I've not seen the number of miniseries that you have. So.
Well, you know, you brought up an interesting point there, and this is going to be a little bit of a sidebar, but I think it's worth discussing. You know, there are ones that you probably, if you're just looking at the value of it in terms of quality, what you think is actually a better program, there are others, but it just means so much to you. I think that a lot of times when we look at works of art and commerce, it's hard to differentiate, but it's also worth taking the time, I think, to understand, you know, that there's the emotional attachment to something, and then there's the actual objective aspects that need to really go into it. For me, probably my personal favorite science fiction show is Babylon 5, but looking at it objectively, I've probably never seen a better one than Battlestar Galactica. You know, there are things that the Twilight Zone did that maybe are as astonishing as anything that's ever been on television, but I can't place it any higher than that, no matter how much of a personal favorite it is. So, I see where you're going with that. So what about you, Aaron? You have similar thoughts on this?
I guess anything, I would say that it's the opposite. I was really just kind of blown away by the technical achievement and the cost of it, while not being as moved by it on a personal level. It was a moving story. I connected with the characters. But for example, some stuff that I have behind it, like Show Me a Hero or 1088, stuff like that. I'm probably connected to, on a personal level, a little more, but didn't think that they were quite as good in a technical, more objective manner.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, now I have this next question, and you know, the way that I put it is this more of a literary thing, or is it grand entertainment? You know, because there were some reviews at the time that acknowledged the source novel, and there were some that actually dismissed the source novel as just a forerunner of what they considered lesser and work. So this is a program that I think has an interesting place in TV history, where you get people that look at it as, oh, it's just a really polished soap, and others that say, no, it's art and it's great. You know, I think it's both. I think, you know, and there's no reason it can't be both. I think that, yeah, it is a soap. It is a little melodramatic in places, but it's also art, and there's no reason that the two shouldn't meet. So, Howard, what do you think of this?
I think it's both. I agree that it is a soap, but so is Anna Glynn. So, soap is just a sort of style or genre or a way something is structured or what the emphasis of a story is. But it is highly literary because it's extremely close to the book. In fact, the John Mortimer script, as I understand, was never used, and the director and others went back to the original book and pretty much just used all the dialogue and the narration straight from the book. But I think it's also highly entertaining. It deals with, I think, issues much deeper than a soap opera would, because it is a Catholic apology. It is about someone achieving grace through Catholicism, because different religions have different ways of achieving grace.
Yeah.
And it's an analysis of the time. It's a look at the time and what happened during it, and the changing world, the changing fortunes of people, how society changed between the wars.
Mhm. Yeah, you know, I do have to say, you know, you'd mentioned grace, and we're going to get back to that, but that's a topic that it's been dealt with a lot in novels and dealt with well. But I haven't seen a lot of movies and very few works on television that even attempted to deal with it maturely. This is, I think, notable for that. But, you know, look at the source material. So, Aaron, your thoughts?
Well, I'm glad Howard brought up Anna Karenina, because I was going to. Anna Karenina is a soap opera, and it's arguably the greatest novel ever written. So that really puts that argument to bed. Yes, it's a soap opera. So is Downton Abbey. And really, they tread a lot of the same ground. They look at the landed gentry of England through the tumultuous 20th century. But it's also ripe and rich history, and that's what both of these series are so great at, is expressing through intimate relationships this grand idea of civilization changing, as you said. And I don't know if I can say anything more eloquently than has already been said. I don't think that we should be trying to separate art and entertainment all of the time. Obviously, there are things that are pure entertainment, and there are things that are purely art, but I don't think that a distinction needs to be made between the two. I don't think that we need to justify watching entertainment by saying, well, it's actually an art film. Or they're deconstructing the idea of an entertainment.
As long as it's good.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I think that's another thing. Go on.
If I could, I just wanted to disagree with you on one issue, and that is, you don't see this subject dealt with much in movies. You actually do if you go to Europe. Europe is rife with films that deal with spiritual values,
yeah.
Spiritual issues. It's in the U.S. that we seem to have a real trouble.
Well, I meant
that.
Specifically the topic of grace itself.
You'll see that quite a bit in European films.
European film, yeah, but even so, you know.
But in the U.S., in the U.S. we can't seem to figure out how to do it or dramatize it in a way. And I had a friend once who said the reason is that in Europe, being a Christian is an intellectual decision. In the U.S., being a Christian is an emotional decision, and that's what makes all the difference in how art approaches it.
Yeah. But, the next question is, you know, Jeremy Irons, who plays Charles Ryder, the focal point of the series, he gets a lot of credit here, as does Laurence Olivier as the head of the Flight family, Lord Marchmain. But this is really just an incredible, incredible cast. And for people who don't know, it's Jeremy Irons, Anthony Andrews, Diana Quick, Phoebe Nichols, Simon Jones, Claire Bloom, John Gielgud, Charles Keating, Nicholas Grace, the list goes on and on. Who do you think deserves credit that often goes without when it comes to conversations about this series? Howard?
Well, I always lay the victory of the series in many ways to Jeremy Irons. But once you leave him, because I thought about this when you asked the question, and I thought there are three outstanding performances outside of Jeremy Irons and Laurence Olivier. One is very small, it's John Le Mercier as that poor priest who is trying to help Rex Mottram become a Catholic, and Rex just doesn't really get it. Mona Washburn, who, if you ever look in a dictionary and look up the word nanny, Mona Washburn's picture is there. And perhaps one of the most brilliant performances, but also one of the most brilliantly written characters, based apparently on Evelyn Waugh's father, is John Gielgud as Edward Ryder. Whenever he's on screen, my mouth just goes open. I mean, the things he says seem so outrageous until you think about them, and sometimes he seems to be the only one who has any sense in the whole movie. But John Gielgud always steals the show whenever he's on screen.
Well, you know, people might say, people were stealing scenes before John Gielgud. Well, I think they need to look back to when John Gielgud actually started in films. He may not have been the first, but he was certainly one of the earliest to become one of the best. The man's an all-timer. What a career, and, you know, you're right. when you watch the series the first time, you're kind of with Charles in regards to his father, but the second time you watch it, you're going, oh no, Daddy doesn't play. Daddy gets it. He just doesn't give a fuck.
Yeah, why are you asking me about whether you should go to art school? You're 22, you know. Or, you know, I think I've run out of my allowance. And well, I wish I could help you. But I've never been in that situation. I've always managed to stay within my allowance. I hope things go well for you. And you're going, well, you know, it is your fault. You did spend all your allowance.
Yep. So what about you, Aaron?
Well, first, a quick note. I know that the Golden Globes are kind of worthless, as we discussed last week. But it is worth noting that Anthony Andrews beat Jeremy Irons at the Golden Globes for Best Lead Performance, even though he disappears halfway through the series. Andrews has also had a celebrated. That being said, the two I really want to highlight are Phoebe Nichols and Diana Quick as Sebastian's sisters, Cordelia and Julia. The second half of this miniseries doesn't work without Charles and Julia having palpable chemistry. And Diana Quick is giving a performance that is easy to fall in love with. And Cordelia is just one of those darling little sisters that they always seem to have in British TV shows and movies. And she does it so well. She's always just delightfully awkward. But she's kind of a North Star in some ways for Charles, because I think he sees her as being the most sincere about her Catholic faith. The others seem a little put upon by it, or a little doddering, like Bridie. But Cordelia always seems sincere and always to be led by her faith. And I think that speaks to Charles.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to go with someone, and I'm doing this purposely here, someone that neither of you have mentioned, and that is Nicholas Grace as Anthony Blanche. You know, that is such an interesting character, and you know, it's also interesting given the period of time the show came out in and what was going on in society and culture. You know, this is a show that does not really shy away from gay issues, and to have a character like, you know, a character that's that, I want to put this the right way, that's that stereotypical and yet not, was fascinating. And I think it really comes down to the incredibly delicate work that Grace does at making him human. And yet, well, he's a bit of a shit, but he's also quite awesome. He's a confidant and he's a spoiler. It's really just a nice little turn, and he has a lot of energy whenever he shows up. So, you know, I really did enjoy that character. But, you know, this is going to be a little bit of a bigger question, but is this primarily a religious spiritual work, or is it just one part of the main character that would be Charles Ryder's journey? So I'll throw this to you, Howard.
Well, that's what the story's about. That's what the book was about. It's about a person achieving grace. there even some people even said that his first affair, he's not really having an affair with Sebastian so much as he's having an affair with the Catholic Church or with the Catholic religion or with Christianity. But then when Sebastian disappears, he goes to Julia, his sister, and continues on this. He doesn't know he's on this journey. In fact, he's rejecting it at all points. But that's what it's about. It's a spiritual journey. And in fact, at the very end, we actually know at the very beginning that he has converted to Catholicism. There's a sort of throwaway line that says that he has. But then at the end, we know for a fact that he has, so that the death of Lord Mortmain and the family as a whole did affect him very deeply. It is about a man who seems to be lost and doesn't really have any meaning in life except through this family of Catholics. So, yeah, I've seen people try to deny that part of the series and the book, and I'm going, I don't know where you get the idea that this is anything but that. While with Catholic writers, there were a whole bunch at the time, along with Graham Greene and many, many others.
Oh, yeah.
And the movie that is later made is in many ways an insult to this because they don't have it as a spiritual journey. And if you ever want to get into that and talk about that, we can talk about
we'll get into that in a little bit, but, you know, I have
right
seen
now,
that movie, and it's terrible.
it is. And that it is a spiritual journey. It's about a man achieving grace through a Catholic way because, as I said, different religions have different ways of achieving
grace. Yeah, and you would then agree that that really is the theme of the series is pointing towards a Judeo-Christian concept of a state of grace. Yeah, I think that's how I've always described it. So what about you?
I think it's more specific than Judeo-Christian. It's Catholic, because many Protestant religions wouldn't see this as the way to achieve.
Oh, yeah. And it's definitely, we know that Waugh himself, that there's a lot of himself in Charles Ryder, that there's a bit of biography in this, that it really is, in a way, the story of his own conversion to Catholicism.
Right.
So, Aaron?
Yeah. It's also, it's spiritual. The whole thing is very spiritual, and it's also existential in a way that those two don't get to commingle very often. Really, Dostoevsky is the one who generally is pointed to as pulling off spiritual existentialism, but I think this does a great job of pulling those two concepts together. This is a man, Charles, that I think that anybody of any faith or non-faith could agree is lost when he starts his journey to Oxford. And whether you agree with his ultimate method of being found, so to speak, I think that there's no doubt that he's in a better place mentally, emotionally, spiritually, despite the fact that he's in the middle of World War II when the story ends. And yes, it's a spiritual journey. It's a journey through a family. It shows him how one very imperfect family can still be very loving in their own way. So he finds love twice. Plus, as I mentioned, he loves Cordelia in his own way, and the father and the mother. maybe not Bridie. but they all shepherd him to use a heavily Christian iconic word. They all shepherd him from his state of being lost to a state of grace. So I'm buying that.
So, you know, my next question is different, and it comes down to this. Is there a character you most identify with, and why? Howard?
I suppose for me it has to be Charles Ryder, both through his discovering of his sexuality first at Oxford and then his spiritual journey, wrestling with those ideas and trying to figure out what is there a God, is there not a God, what does that mean to me, how do I decide to lead my life. So for me, it's definitely Charles Ryder.
What about you, Aaron?
Charles is obviously the POV character. He's the character with whom I share the most empathy. I don't know if I personally identified with any of them. Maybe that was the one slight disconnect I had with the work. But in a way, I loved all of them, but couldn't necessarily see myself in any of them. Cordelia is wonderful, but maybe a little more idealistic. She's probably 10 years younger than I am, too. But I maybe Julia, in a way. She knows what she wants, and she's just bad at getting it. But not even her. I think Charles is the one that I guess I relate to the most, but it's still more of an empathetic view than identifying view.
Yep. And now we come to our final big question. And this is going to kind of break down into smaller sections, but the series has two sections, really. There's the early parts at school and just after, when Charles and Sebastian are a thing, and then there's really everything else. Does this bifurcation work, and if so, why and to what purpose? For me, I've always thought this. Is it possible this is meant to be an analog to Charles's subsummation of his sexuality? My take has always been that he's bisexual and male-leaning, but that he truly did love Julia. So what do you guys think? Howard?
Well, I think it works. I don't really have an issue with it. It works better in the movie than the book, because the big problem with the book is once Sebastian disappears, the book isn't quite as interesting. And Aaron mentioned Julia as being a very important character, and she certainly is in the series, because in the book she's very bland and uninteresting. But in the series, she's much more interesting. She's much better written. And because of that, the bifurcation works a lot, lot better. But I think it works because the series works for me. Whether it would be better without the bifurcation, you know, I don't know. I'm not sure how else to tell the story, because there's so much, there's the way the plot is, there has to be this long separation between Charles Ryder and the family, and all this stuff has to happen in between for the second half to work. So, in fact, there's that one there's the one episode where Julia tells her story. It's just all exposition. There's no drama. I mean, it's really nothing. It's just all exposition. I'm going, oh, they had to write this in to fill in everything that happened in the two parts.
Yeah, and I think there was, you know, that originally it was supposed to be even longer, and then there was the stoppage, and they tried to make it shorter, and they decided, no, we can make it longer, but we're going to have to cut an hour or so here. And I do wonder if, you know, things like Julia's story weren't things that suffered. I mean, you know, you wouldn't think that an hour spread over a nearly 12-hour series would make that much of a difference, but, you know, it really can.
Yeah. It's just odd. It's one of those, almost every series seems to have that one episode where you're going, oh, this is just here to get us to the rest of the story.
Yep. Actually, there is one episode that it's very talky, and it's a transitional episode. It's also a bit of a bottle episode, but for me it works, and that is the fifth episode, set at the beach house in the recent miniseries Fosse Verdon. That's extraordinary. But, you know, that's just a whole different beast. So what about you, Aaron? What are your thoughts on this?
So I have two conflicting thoughts because, yes, the second half still works because, as I mentioned before, Jeremy Irons and Diana Quick have such great chemistry, and Julia is so well drawn. But you lose a lot of energy. The first half of the series is so dynamic with those characters. His friends there in Oxford, they're all incredibly interesting. They're all dynamite. They're all talk a mile a minute. It's kind of a Amy Palladino show. as far as words per minute coming out of mouths. And then the second half becomes very contemplative. And that's really where we start to see Charles really doing the work of this journey. Obviously, the journey has started already, but it's where the journey gets hard. And again, it definitely works. The dramatic moments all pay off. The chemistry between Quick and Irons is incredible. And I don't think the series suffers from the bifurcation, but I don't think that it necessarily reaches any new pinnacles either. I think that it plateaus a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that pretty much covers it. I knew this was going to be a shorter episode. I figured, you know, 45 minutes to 75 minutes. You know, before we start to wrap this up, Howard, you mentioned that you have several connected issues and topics that you want to bring up.
Yeah, just some of them are fun little things in connection to it. I do want to mention that the series is actually an improvement on the book. As much as I love the book, because of the second half, is so much more interesting than the book. The series is quite an improvement there. I did see the movie, and you're right, it's a terrible movie, but what upset me about the movie is, for some reason, they took out the spiritual journey.
Mm-hmm.
And they made three major changes that showed that either they didn't understand the book, or they were scared of the book, or they just didn't care. And one is when they first go to the chapel, when Charles and Sebastian go to the chapel, and Sebastian takes holy water and crosses himself, and Charles starts to do it, and Sebastian says, "Why are you doing that?" Well, in the series in the book, he says, "Just good manners." Okay, that's fine. In the movie, he says, "I'm trying to fit in." And at that point, the movie is no longer a spiritual journey. It's all about a social climber. And that's all the story's about. He's trying to use the family and the Catholicism in order to climb the social ladder. When he goes to Rex for the divorce, Rex's attitude is, "If you give me 4 of your paintings, I'll agree to the annulment." As if it's that easy to get an annulment. It's not quite that easy. That's not in the book. It's not in the series. And Charles agrees to it, and then Julie gets upset because she's basically being bought and sold. But then the big issue at the very end is that in the series and the book, he is converted to Catholicism. He's done it off screen, and he's done it outside of the story of the book. But he is definitely converted. It's almost impossible to argue that, and Evelyn Waugh says that's what happened. In the series, he doesn't. What also upset me is that the critics at the time praised the film for being faithful to the book. And I'm going, no, this is not faithful to the book at all. Either you haven't read the book or you have no idea what the book is about.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's you know.
Yeah, it would be like somebody saying that Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was a faithful recreation of the Manson murders.
Yeah, it's just, you know. There's a book called The Glittering Crisis by Frederick Raphael, who's a novelist and screenwriter. And it's sort of semi-autobiographical about his days at college. I don't know if he went to Oxford or not. But the first chapter is all about his rooming with a Catholic roommate. He comes from a family similar to the Flight. And it's obviously written in response to Brideshead Revisited. At one point, the central character played by Tom Conti is Jewish. That's one of the major differences, is actually reading Brideshead Revisited. So that's a nice little tidbit if someone wants to read The Glittering Crisis or see the series. And this first chapter is a response to Brideshead Revisited. As you mentioned, Evelyn Waugh divorced his first wife for adultery, as Charles Ryder does in the movie, and then converts to Catholicism and then remarries. In the 1980s, I was working at this place, and I brought in the paper, and I tended to read the obituary. And I turned to the obituary, and can you believe it? The title of the obituary was, "Evelyn Waugh's Adulterous First Wife Died." And I'm going, why would you use that as a title to an obituary? That is her only claim to fame, being his first wife cheated on him and he divorced her. But that was the big title.
Yeah, and when you look,
was
and when you look
the,
her up,
was she the other Evelyn?
Huh?
Was she the other Evelyn, girl Evelyn? Because one of his wives was also named Evelyn, which was apparently very funny.
Yes. They were called the he Evelyn and the she Evelyn, and that was Evelyn.
Yeah.
She cheated on him.
Yeah, and when you look her up, she's one of the bright young things. She was in that group. So, you know, this was a woman. I think she was a baroness. Married like 5 or 6 times. Dozens, lots of kids. So you know that's an unfortunate epitaph for her. But what about you?
And let's face it, Waugh was a bit of a social climber. There's only two other things real quick I want to mention. If you've ever seen the movie The Loved One, we have Brideshead Revisited to thank for that book, because Hollywood wanted to make a movie out of Brideshead Revisited. Evelyn Waugh went to Hollywood. They couldn't come to an agreement on it. The censors were a big problem. And even though Wall was so angry, while there, you know, he visited Forest Lawn and found the whole thing fascinating, and he was so angry about it that when he came back, he wrote The Loved One as an attack on Hollywood. And the final thing to remember here is, and one of the saddest things about the story, is this is the end of the flight. The family is over. There is nobody to inherit. It's the bloodline is dead. And I think sometimes people miss that. There is no longer going to be another flight. Once Julie dies, who knows what's going to happen to Brideshead Castle, because she's sort of in charge of it now.
Yeah, because we know Sebastian's never going to have kids. We know Cordelia's never going to have kids. Julia isn't going to have kids. And, well, it's pretty obvious Bridie has no interest.
Well, it's also that he marries someone who's past menopause, and she can't have
kids. Yeah, so, and that's why I said it's obvious. And, Bridie's so into himself that I don't think it was completely coincidental that he found a woman who was not of childbearing years. So, Aaron, any last things you want to say about this before we get going?
I was very surprised, frankly, with how frank and honest and also delicately this series handled all forms of sex. I thought that they found a very interesting way to be very frank with the gay material early on without being overt in a way that might get them shut out by censors. And then there was a sequence later in the series, in the second half, between him and Julia that really was quite graphic sexually, but also handled very delicately, that really caught me off guard. Like, wait, this was 1981 on television? I know it's Britain, but come on.
And that was kind of controversial. Before this, we have I, Claudius, and people started talking about how sexually frank and nudity was allowed in British series and not in the U.S.
No, it's definitely a noteworthy work in so many ways. It's for me, it's the best adaptation of any Wall material. It definitely, as Aaron said, it trod some very interesting, delicate ground. It's a fine series. It's not going to be for everyone. But I definitely think that if it sounds interesting, give it a look. It is available on streaming services, both for rent and purchase as well as just to stream. It is on disc. I'm not sure if it's on Blu-ray, but I do know it's got a couple of different DVD sets that are available.
DVD only.
Yep. I know they've been talking about Blu-ray for a while, but I didn't know if maybe they'd put one out yet. But I know that when I bought it last year, when I finally got my set, I ended up importing the Region 2 DVD. So that's what I did. But
it's also
go on.
It's also available for free on IMDb TV. Ads at the beginning and end of each episode. So.
Yeah.
If you don't want to spend anything, that's a good way to do it.
Yeah.
That's how I felt.
I think Prime has it, so yeah. But maybe it's on Prime via IMDb, but
yeah, it is.
So,
that's how I saw
it. So next week, over the next week or so, Carl has said for me to say that there's nothing scheduled with the other shows, but stay tuned. There will be announcements when something comes up. So until then, the only thing definitely scheduled for Deviant Legion is my next two shows. And next week, next Friday, April 2nd, we have an episode. We're going to have a bunch of people. We've got about five or six guests, which is unusual for the show. The topic, both our favorite and our choices for the best pilot episodes of ongoing series of all time. So it should just be a fun, loose episode. And, you know, it's an episode that came together last week. Was it last time?
On air.
Yeah, it was last time when Aaron and I were having our long discussion. But, you know, and this, and then the following week, April 9th, will be an episode on the films of Studio Ghibli, but also with a focus on the films of Miyazaki and Takahata. So I really do hope that you out there will join us for those episodes. Looking quite forward to that. And once again, thank you all for listening. Thank both of you for coming on the show. I knew this was going to be a short one, and it definitely ended up being one of our shortest. But, you know, sometimes short and sweet and to the point is best. It's definitely going to be a different thing than these marathon three-hour episodes, which are wonderful. But, you know, I don't want to dip into that well. I'm sure it tests the audience's stamina as much as it does mine and my guests. So with that, I want to once again thank everyone for participating, and we will say good night.
Good night.
On one, good night. Two. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.